Well, we got a busy day ahead of us here on Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We don't usually come to you live on Friday. On Friday, you're usually listening to a rebroadcast of our Sunday Night National Edition and a best of. But on this Friday, it's a special treat for everybody, us included. We're broadcasting live from the Lutheran Chapel of Hope on the campus of Southeast Missouri State University in Cape Girardeau, Missouri. Our guest here in the first hour, David Limbaugh. He's an attorney here in Cape Girardeau. You might recognize the name because he has a rather famous brother, Rush Limbaugh, who I hear also has a radio program as well. And he's a syndicated columnist. You might have been reading him for quite some time, or one of his books, Absolute Power, and his latest that's been making the rounds on the, it's also on the New York Times bestsellers list, Persecution, How Liberals Are Waging War Against Christianity. Now, if you'd like to join us here in the first half hour or the following couple hours of Issues, etc., feel free to do so at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. A little later in this hour, Pastor David Disson is our guest. We're going to be talking about campus ministry. He has a long and storied career as a pastor in the Lutheran Church, and then at the end of his career and in his golden years, he has decided that he will enter campus ministry and start dealing with the youth of the church. He is pastor of the Lutheran Chapel of Hope here in Cape Girardeau. We'll be talking to him about the challenges of campus ministry. And then we'll have a pastor's roundtable, several pastors from the area, Southeast Missouri here, to join us to talk about the challenges facing the church and the culture. We'll also have a student's roundtable and a layperson's roundtable in these 3 hours of Issues, etc. Those phone numbers, again, are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We're coming to you live this, the 16th day of April. It's Friday, and it's Issues, etc. David Limbaugh is an attorney here in Cape Girardeau, a native of Cape Girardeau, a syndicated columnist and author of that book, Persecution, How Liberals Are Waging War Against Christianity. David, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
David, you have the distinction of being a native of this area of the country. Tell us about your life growing up in Cape Girardeau as we begin.
Pretty unremarkable, really.
Really?
Yeah, just grew up in a normal, well, I don't know about normal, eccentric family. And a family of lawyers, actually. And we went to school here, grade school here, junior high and high school here. And I went to college at Southeast Missouri State. And I ended up going to the University of Missouri Columbia for 3 years to finish my undergraduate and then went to the law school there, too. But really, life here is great, great for family life and raising a family. We're now raising a family. I've got four kids. So I love this city. Little city though it is.
Well, it's a beautiful city as well. What was it like growing up in that family? Certainly no one knew in advance that it would be a family whose name is now famous, not only on account of your publishing and your writing, but also on account of Rush's radio program.
Yeah, pretty much on account of my brother. Well, nobody, of course, ever knows in advance something like that is going to happen. However, my grandfather, in his own right, was pretty prominent. He practiced law until he was 103, died at 104, was president of Missouri Bar, wrote two books on probate law that were used as textbooks by all the law firms in the state, and he had quite a reputation. My dad was a lawyer. My uncle was a lawyer, now a federal judge. My cousin is a Supreme Court justice. So the families had established roots in town. And then my brother, of course, went the unorthodox approach. He always had a talent for broadcasting, and you know, he broke all records, broke the mold and broke all records, and is doing better than all of us put together. So more power to him. And then he gave me the inspiration to go out on my own to write and do that kind of thing, express my political opinion in the form of commentaries and columns. So seeing him and his success kind of inspired me to do this.
Was it a family of political opinion?
Oh, my gosh, yes. My grandfather was a Republican and conservative. My dad broke the mold on conservative political thought.
Really?
Way ahead of his time. Used to constantly, I reluctantly say this in front of Reverend Disson, but swear at Walter Cronkite for distorting the news and editorializing when he was supposed to be giving us the news. That's what made my dad so mad. So he taught us, gave us the worldview or helped us acquire the worldview that we now have. And I taught us, I think, to independently think for ourselves.
So the apples did not fall far from the tree in this case at all?
Probably not.
Just as a matter of curiosity, how is Rush doing, not only with the recent news, but also he's waging a war down there, a legal battle of his own in Florida?
Right. He is doing exceptionally well. There are so many people that have prayed and offered their support. It's been very overwhelming and very humbling. And he's on the top of his game. I won't comment about what's going on down there. I don't think it's my place. But fully supportive of him, and I think his radio show's about as good as it's ever been. We need his voice out there. The Democrats, the liberals, are trying to undermine our culture, and they're doing it with a vengeance. The Democratic Party has become a vehicle for the undermining of the Judeo-Christian worldview in this country, for the establishment of secular humanist principles in place, not in coexistence with, but in place of the Judeo-Christian worldview. And I think our entire library of freedoms are in jeopardy, and we need to fight back. And I think Rush is an essential voice in that. I'm doing my little part with my little forum. I know you guys are doing a great job in your roles as well.
Let's talk about a few of the particulars, beginning with the news that's going to occupy us for the next 8 months or so, and that's the 2004 presidential election. I cannot remember an election season beginning as early as this one has, in the sense that we actually got two people facing off even before either party has had their convention.
Yes. Well, you know, I wrote a column in, I think it was January of 2000, right after the election. Would that be 2001? Because the election was 2000. Yeah, so it'd be called the 4 Years War. I thought then that the Democrats were going to be at Bush's throat for the entire 4 years with a vengeance. They have been. It's not that I had that I'm a prophet or have any crystal ball, but it was so obvious given their antipathy and their vitriol in the election, in the Florida election. They tried to steal overtly, and then when the Republicans were able to rescue it away from the corruption of the Florida Supreme Court, the Democrats have now convinced themselves and tried to convince others through revising history that the Republicans stole the election. And they have had such bitterness about it, which I think proceeds from their worldview. It doesn't proceed from facts. I mean, you can see anymore that there is such a polarization in the two sides, which I think are worldview oriented, that, and not clear cut worldview, Christian versus secular, but along those general lines, Republican, Democrat, that if, except for the brief hiatus after 9/11, when Democrats had to at least, I don't want to say pretend because I don't want to be disparaging, but after they were honor bound to support President Bush for that period of time, just for whatever precious short period it was, and then right after that, they immediately started after him again, shamelessly. And they still do. We're at war, and they're at war with him. We're at war against the terrorists. The Democrats are at war with President Bush. And I think undermining the morale of the troops and undermining the cause against the war on terror and undermining the cause of freedom worldwide. I know those are bold words, but I mean them.
Sure. Do you think if the tables were turned and the Florida election had swung the other direction, giving us former Vice President Al Gore as president, and another, and 9/11 would have, I see an answer forming.
Nitroglycerin.
But if then a 9/11 occurs, do you think that the Republican Party would have had the same kind of attack dog mentality?
From the bottom of my heart, I think emphatically not. Moreover, I don't think Al Gore would have gone after the terrorists. I think he would have swatted flies, to use George Bush's now famous phrase. Bill Clinton continued to swat flies. I think that everybody acts like it's a foregone conclusion that when 9/11 happened, anyone that was president would have taken bold, firm action. Mm-hmm. I think we have seen through the Democrats' actions in resisting President Bush, unless you just want to assume it was for the sheer purpose of opposing him and making him look bad, which, of course, I do think, then we have to assume that they would not have been as strong against terrorists as President Bush has been. And therefore, I'm not sure we would have had anything to react to. But assuming, for purpose of your question, that they did react as decisively as Bush has, I say unequivocally we would not have done that. We would have supported them. Now, I didn't support Clinton and Kosovo because I didn't think we had a national interest at stake, but I think it's a legitimate debate. But of course we would have. So, as my brother mentioned on his show, Republicans always get behind a Democratic president in time of war because it's not about politics, about partisan politics. We even got behind Jimmy Carter when he had his failed hostage rescue mission in Iran, if you remember. I mean, so it's it's not all Republicans good, liberals bad. I'm not, or Democrats bad. It's pretty close.
Our call-in numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We have a couple of David's books to give away. David Limbaugh, attorney here in Cape Girardeau, Rush Limbaugh's brother, a syndicated columnist and author of the book Persecution, How Liberals Are Waging War Against Christianity, is our guest. And our best callers get a free copy of his book, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's talk briefly about some of the strengths and the weaknesses of the two men who will be facing off in November 2004, beginning with the presumptive Democratic candidate, John Kerry.
John Kerry is an elitist from the Northeast who has been designated by the the National Journal, which is an objective. It's certainly not a partisan magazine. It's a Washington Beltway political magazine, as the most liberal voting senator in 2003. He's clearly wanting to distance himself from that, but that's a pretty much objective analysis. He has been anti-war since he came back from Vietnam. He's been consistent undercutting our defense programs, and I think the attitude he had in 1971 when he was adopting the views of Jane Fonda and cavorting with the anti-war groups, he still has today. I wrote a column, John Kerry 2004 equals John Kerry 1971. I believe that. Now, his strengths, I guess he is fairly articulate. However, if you listen to the substance of what he says, he doesn't really say much. I mean, he continues to go in the sing-song, stentorian voice with I think, feigned indignation at George Bush for things that George Bush is doing, but he rarely offers much affirmatively. I think what he has going for him probably is just the fact that there are enough people that hate Bush that will give him that modicum level of support where he'll be a formidable contender no matter what. I also wrote a column. I'm not trying to cite myself. It's just because these are the thoughts I had
when
I wrote them. So I don't need to say I had a column. I just say I thought and I continue to think that Kerry is really a default candidate. The Democrats realized they had an unstable candidate in Howard Dean and immediately shifted and bought this pig in a poke with John Kerry, having had no interest in him prior to that time. And they didn't really know what they were getting. All they knew is that at least according to appearances, he wasn't a crazy man, and he hated Bush as much as Dean, just not as vocally. And that was the primary criterion. I'm not being facetious. Mm-hmm. Hating Bush is number one in the criterion. And I think he satisfied that, but I think he's been all over the board. His record is completely inconsistent. He is, you know, talks about, uses class warfare, and he happens to be married to one of the richest women around. And, of course, she won't release her tax returns. So, anyway, I'm off the point. I can't think of too many strengths. I'm trying to fumble around thinking of strengths, but given my bias, it's tough for me to do that.
What about his war record as a strength or a weakness?
Boy, if he keeps pushing it, people might start beginning to really investigate how he could get three flesh wounds and ask for his own early out inside of 4 months. And people have really raised the question. I don't want to do that. You know, I don't want to besmirch this. It's almost a sacred thing. You don't, in this country, you don't want to challenge or question somebody's war record, somebody who's reputed to be a hero. But if he keeps invoking this Vietnam thing, which I think is absolutely irrelevant when it comes to what policies he advocates and his fitness as commander-in-chief. George Bush didn't see any combat, and he's been a stellar commander-in-chief. I think, though, if he keeps pushing it, there's more credence attached to these stories about questioning his record every day. I don't want to go there. I just think there might be something to it.
David Limbaugh is our guest. By the way, you can read David Limbaugh's columns on the web at worldnetdaily.com. That website, worldnetdaily.com. He's mentioned a couple of the subjects there, and you might want to go back and review those for yourselves.
Can I mention
Daily?
Yes. I also have a new website, davidlimbaugh.com, and they're there, too, with the archives.
All right. Thank you very much. What do you think the outcome will be in November?
I think Bush will win. And I mean that. I am very optimistic without being smug or overconfident about it because I'm still nervous, obviously. If I weren't nervous, I'd probably quit writing about what I consider to be Democratic misdeeds. But I'm passionate about that. I think there have been so many things that the Democrats have done that need to be countered, that's what I pretty much devoted my column to in the last few months. I definitely think Bush will win because I think the people ultimately can see his goodness, can see that he is a true leader, and I think an authentic Christian. I really do, and I think that shines through.
What did you make of his third live press conference, primetime press conference, that was aired this week?
You know, I didn't see it live because I had a hospital board meeting, and I came home, I had it recorded, and I watched it, and I know I'm going to sound like just a complete partisan. I was a little bit surprised that people thought he was as bad as they thought he was. I thought he was pretty direct, pretty straightforward. Nobody has said that he is a model of clarity and verbal skill and articulateness. But I thought his message was clear. I thought he tried to earnestly answer the questions. I didn't think he tried to duck anything. He refused to apologize because he has nothing to apologize for, especially about how he conducted himself prior to 9/11. I was not disappointed with his performance. I don't expect him to be some stellar verbal performer, and he's never held himself out as being one. He gives a pretty good stump speech when it's written for him, and he delivers it fairly well. But his dad was very awkward at verbally, very awkward. And yet
more awkward, I think. Yeah.
More, and yet nobody questions his dad's intelligence. Have you ever noticed that? My point being that being articulate and smooth and glib does not mean you're brilliant, and being inarticulate does not mean you're a moron.
Before, as we get a gathering crowd here, I'd like to mention that we do have an audience microphone here that, as I give out the phone numbers, that's also an invitation to our audience here at the Lutheran Chapel of Hope for questions and comments as we talk with David Limbaugh, author of the book Persecution. David, you mentioned John Kerry's weaknesses going into the presidential election. What about the weaknesses of the president going into this election?
Well, I think there's a few weaknesses. One, obviously, again, not that great on his feet sometimes. Sometimes he is. Sometimes he'll surprise you in debates, but a lot of times he's not. I think he has a little bit of a pure heart, and while that is honorable and is an attribute, he also, I think, underestimates his political enemies. For example, wanting to extend the olive branch to Ted Kennedy and wanting to set this new tone in Washington, and these guys just stab him in the back. And I think his overtures to domestic liberalism, whether it be the No Child Left Behind Act, the excessive domestic spending, the steel tariff issue, the affirmative action, backtracking on that, the signing the campaign finance reform bill, saying that it's probably not going to pass constitutional muster anyway. See, the executive has an obligation to honor the Constitution as well and not to just put it off on the court. It's a co-equal branch. And his immigration pseudo-amnesty policy, a lot of these have gotten him in trouble with the conservative base. I don't ultimately think those are going to detract too much in the final analysis with the voting, because the most important issue facing us, obviously, is terrorism. And we need him, and conservatives, except those that are just single-issue people, realize that it's important to subordinate certain weaknesses that Bush has in favor of the strengths. Plus, he's been very good, I think, on the pro-life issue. A few glitches there, but pretty good, pretty strong on the pro-life issue, and very good on taxes, and he's stuck by that. The tax thing, and the economy is rebounding as a direct result of his tax cuts, and we've countered the recession that he inherited when he came into office. So he's going to have a strong record to run on. Now, they've attempted to undermine all the good things he's done in Iraq. I mean, you have unrest and terrorist-fomented violence in Iraq after we decisively won the war, and it is not caused by Iraqi citizens proper who are unhappy that we liberated them from one of the most murderous tyrants in the history of the world. It is happening by international terrorists and hangovers from the Saddam regime and other assorted terrorists who have a vested interest in thwarting democracy in the Middle East and elsewhere in the world. And the liberals have the audacity to say that that is evidence that the Iraqis aren't receiving us with flowers. The truth is they are, and George Bush really has a stellar record. We can't, I put in this column today, it is highly arrogant and dangerous for us in the United States, because we are the sole superpower, to think we are impervious to and completely invincible to casualties and violence. If we fight wars, we're going to have casualties. And the fact that we do is not a black mark on George Bush's record. So I don't see him being that vulnerable. However, they're going to paint the picture that he is, and I think the rest of us will just have to try to counter that image.
I have a lot more questions for you. Would you be willing to stick with us through the break here, David?
Yeah, be glad to.
Thank you very much. With about 2 minutes before we go to this break, what do you make of the comparison that's been made? And it's being made now. At first it was made kind of quietly. Now it's being made openly between Iraq and Vietnam.
I think it is absurd and offensive and dangerous. And destructive. There is no comparison. We won the war. We didn't even try to win the Vietnam War. We tried to contain the North Vietnam communists who were being supplied by the Soviets and the Red Chinese in North Vietnam. We charged our troops with not firing till being fired upon, not taking over territory, and we could have won that war, but the analogy is the anti-war types who undermined our effort and ultimately caused us to pull out, causing a bloodbath in Southeast Asia and Cambodia, which, by the way, John Kerry, I think, contributed to, and he still has that attitude today. The parallel is the same anti-war types still carry on today, and John Kerry is one of them, undermining the war effort over there while he speaks out of both sides of his mouth. But I think there is literally no comparison. We were fighting communism over there. We're fighting unconventional warriors in the form of terrorists here. But we've already won the war. I want to say that emphatically. We've won the war. We're now fighting terrorists and insurgents, and we're trying to transition into democracy. That is a very difficult process, even if you don't have violent resistance. And we have violent resistance, as Tony Blair said today, as we approach this deadline, June 30th. Of course, they're going to accelerate their opposition. And that means we should accelerate and strengthen our resolve to try to hang in there and establish this, not adhere doggedly, arbitrarily to a deadline, but do not be deterred by actions of terrorists, because that will just encourage them to do more.
We're talking to David Limbaugh, attorney here in Cape Girardeau. We're broadcasting live from the Lutheran Chapel of Hope on the campus of Southeast Missouri State University in Cape Girardeau. Join us at 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. The best callers will receive a copy of David Limbaugh's new book on the New York Times bestseller called Persecution, How Liberals Are Waging War Against Christianity. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. If you're listening on the Internet, as I know many of you are, feel free to give us a call, 1-800-730-2727. We'll let you stay on the line to hear the response to your question or your comment. When we come back, more with David Limbaugh, syndicated columnist and author of the books Absolute Power and Persecution, How Liberals Are Waging War Against Christianity. A little later in the hour, Pastor David Disson will be our guest as well. When we come back, we're going to talk about the 9/11 Commission with David Limbaugh.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most talk radio shows, but not for Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is listener-supported. That means we rely on you to pay the production, salaries, and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin, asking you to prayerfully consider making a financial gift to Issues, Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You can donate by credit card, 1-800-737-0172. Or you can donate by check, Issues, Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues, Etc. needs your financial support. We depend upon you for the continuation and expansion of Issues, Etc.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on Jewish families around the globe. So let's hear where they live. About 5 million Jewish peoples live in Israel, and about 5 million live in the United States. The upcoming issue of the Global Prayer Digest magazine lists other places with large Jewish populations. 2 million in Europe, 400,000 in Latin America, and fewer than 100,000 in Africa. There are about 14 million Jewish people around the world today. There are three major movements in Judaism: Orthodox, Conservative, and Reformed. The Orthodox Jews today believe they must live by the rabbinical laws, while the Reformed Jews may include people who are agnostics. Articles about the Jewish people in the Global Prayer Digest magazine direct us to pray so that Christians will be more willing to share Christ's love. Get more prayer news from around the world by visiting the website missionvisionnetwork.org. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Sunday marks the anniversary of a great exercise in hope. On April 18, 1942, Lieutenant Colonel Jimmy Doolittle led the first bombing raid on Tokyo in World War II. 16 B-25 bombers, normally land-based planes, took off from the aircraft carrier USS Hornet. That incredibly difficult mission was an exercise in hope. Coming 5 months after Pearl Harbor, Doolittle's raid encouraged America to sacrifice toward victory. Activate hope in your life. Grow it with a conviction that the Christ who conquered death can certainly bring you through present problems to a heavenly victory. Apply it to the specific problems of your life. Pray it for others and for our troubled world. Hope, without specific prescriptions, but with this confidence: for those who love God, all things work together for good. Romans 8:28. Hope is a lively thing, says 1 Peter 1:3, when it's focused on the right object, on God, who raised Jesus from the dead and gave him glory, so that your faith and hope are in God. 1 Peter 1:21. Out of such hope in the God of resurrection, we make our own raids on the enemy of despair. The flowers on last Sunday's lilies are fading, but your hope, let it bloom.
Learn how you can easily create a well-designed garden with color and personality at Southern Living Magazine's Gardening School on Saturday, April 17th at the Missouri Botanical Garden, 4344 Shaw Boulevard in St. Louis. It's a three-session seminar. You can do it. Gardening Basics to Big Ideas is what it's called. It'll be held from 9 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. in the Schoenberg Auditorium. For more information, contact the Missouri Botanical Garden. The cost is $40, or you can visit www.mobot.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. David Limbaugh is our guest. He's been kind enough to agree to stick around with us and take your questions and your comments and continue our conversation as we talk about the 2004 presidential race, the culture war. We're going to be talking about the 9/11 Commission here in just a moment as well. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We are coming to you live this Friday. It's the 16th. Is it the 16th day? My goodness, tax day just passed us by. 16th day of April, coming to you live from the Lutheran Chapel of Hope here in Cape Girardeau, Missouri, on the campus of Southeast Missouri State University. David Limbaugh is our guest. Best callers, best questions during this hour with David. Get a copy of his book, Persecution, How Liberals Are Waging War Against Christianity. We got a question here from the floor. What's your name and what's your question?
Ron Matley from Wapapello, Missouri, formerly from Cape Girardeau. David, in your opinion, in what time in the future will we quit comparing every conflict to Vietnam?
Well, I think as long as liberal baby boomers can get political mileage out of making the comparison, they'll do so. The New York Times editorial page suggested that we are going to get in a quagmire. Quagmire is the same thing as Vietnam. They're synonymous, quagmire, Vietnam. Of course, I repeat what I said before. We were in a quagmire in Vietnam because we chose to be. And we got into a bigger one when the politics entered in and undermined our military cause. But they talked about quagmire in Afghanistan within a few weeks. These people are crazy. I mean, it is outrageous. It's an insult to our military. They started doing it in Iraq when we were setting records for military accomplishment. They said our supply lines were getting behind our troops. I mean, my gosh, this is war. And they said we don't plan adequately. Like you're going to plan against an unpredictable, unconscionable, immoral, amoral enemy. You can't plan for these unpredictable attacks. I resent people not having the originality of thought to even question that assertion that Bush didn't plan adequately for terror. I mean, maybe you can say he didn't anticipate. I don't think you can anticipate. You have no idea how many people are going to foment violence like this Al Sadr guy who comes out of the woodwork, who didn't even have the freedom under Saddam Hussein, who killed his relatives, by the way. He didn't even have the freedom to kill people before. Now we've liberated these people to kill us. Some of them. That's just a small percentage. But I think they're going to continue to use Vietnam as long as it's politically expedient for them to do so. But I don't think they're ultimately getting any mileage. What they're saying, though, and what they don't dare quite say, they don't quite come out and say it directly, is that this cause is not noble any more than the Vietnam cause was. But I want to say this. It's not politically correct to say. It's not popular to say. But the Vietnam cause was noble. We had a noble cause in trying to contain communism. Communism was a godless, tyrannical, totalitarian system, and that we were moral in opposing it. And those people who undermined our opposition to it were immoral, including John Kerry. And yet these people have the moral high ground today, and they claim vindication because we lost the Vietnam War, proving that they were right all along, when in fact, that we lost because of them, and then when we withdrew, contrary to what they predicted, there was a bloodbath, which vindicates us, those of us who were supportive of containing communism. And the Cold Warriors have been completely vindicated, and everything that's come out since that has vindicated the Cold Warriors, and yet these people, these anti-war people, have never been held to account. I say, as John Kerry would say, bring it on. Let's get an accounting of who stood where, and if we can re-revise history back to the correct version of accounts, John Kerry and his ilk won't sit very well with the American people.
Another question here from the audience. What's your name and what's your question?
Hello, my name is Kirk Sanford. I'm from Perryville. My question is, with the recent election in California of Arnold Schwarzenegger, do you think this November that California will swing that way and vote for Bush over Kerry?
Excellent question. Thank you very much.
You know, that is an interesting question. I haven't seen polling very recently. I would say this. It would help to put it into play. My gut would tell me that he wouldn't win it, but I think that Arnold can help pave the ground. The fact that he won paves the ground. We've got to remember, though, that Arnold is a social liberal, and that he wouldn't have been able to win without satisfying the pro-abortionists and that type of thing. So he's not really what I consider anywhere close to a social conservative. I'm not really even sure he's a fiscal conservative. I like the guy, you know, at least he's a patriot. But I'm not sure how. I know the Republican Party apparatus is going to be stronger. A win is thinkable now in California. If I were a betting man, I would say, and Reverend Disson's here, I can't be, I would say, I'm really not anyway. That's one vice I don't have. One of the few vices I don't have. Not even interested in gambling, but I would say we will lose California. But I'm going to fight for it.
Yeah,
we're going to fight.
Well, very briefly, does a win in California, even a squeaker for George W. Bush, absolutely cinch him in November of 2004?
I think it would, don't you? I mean, if we got that one, that would be pretty. He'd have to do poorly elsewhere. Mm-hmm. I would think so.
Real quick question on the 9/11 Commission. Just your thoughts on that in a minute or less.
impossible. I'm a Limbaugh. No, I think it was set up by some people to be a partisan witch hunt against George Bush to try to take focus away from the fact that Bill Clinton really didn't do much of a good job against terrorism, treated it more as a law enforcement problem, refused to accept Osama bin Laden, handed on a silver platter by Sudan, treated terrorists as swatting flies or diversionary attention from Monica Lewinsky, whatever. But the fact that they chose Richard Benveniste as one of their members, Jamie Gorelick, who was in the Reno Justice Department, who we now know is responsible for the wall memo that separated our intelligence services and kept them from communicating with each other, which may have been the most instrumental factor in the weaknesses in our intelligence service. But then you watch the reprehensible way that the Democrats on that commission have treated Condoleezza Rice, John Ashcroft, and other witnesses, when they're supposed to be a fact-finding body and not an adversarial body, I think it is illustrative of what they are up to and what we're up against. This commission never should have been organized during a war. We need to be united during this war. They would never have done that with the Pearl Harbor Commission until afterwards, which they didn't. You just can't, in a democratic state or a constitutional republic, continue to beat yourself up and undermine yourself. You've got to stay united, at least during time of war. I know they're downsized to a democratic open society, which means the enemies of society that live among you are free to tear you down. And we've got to, that's one of the prices of liberty. But it sure is a hard pill to swallow during wartime. And I wish they would have deferred until afterwards. But I think they're showing their true colors in the way they're representing themselves. You just watch, anybody that watches that with an objective perspective will see that they treated the Republican and administration witnesses with contempt and disrespect and treated the others, like Janet Reno, with kid gloves. And I think it was really regrettable how they did it.
Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Talking with David Limbaugh, Rush Limbaugh's brother, attorney here in Cape Girardeau, syndicated columnist and author of several books, including Absolute Power and his latest on the New York Times bestseller list, Persecution, How Liberals Are Waging War Against Christianity. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. On issues of the culture war with regard to social and moral issues, David, let's talk about, I know this, you've written recently about this, and this is something that I know that frustrates you and a lot of people, and that is judicial activism.
Yes.
First of all, define it, if you could.
Okay.
And where did it come from, and where is it leading us? How do we stop it?
I was on a panel with some other conservatives, Ann Coulter and Jay Sekulow, at Regent University, Pat Robertson's school, and we debated Alan Dershowitz and Nadine Strasser and Strassen and Barry Lynn of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. And we were arguing about judicial activism and what it meant for the future of freedom. I think our framers established a government where they divided power vertically between state and federal government and local governments, called a system of federalism. You divide and diffuse power, and you preserve liberty because you limit government. You get these branches competing against each other, and therefore none gets too powerful at the expense of the other, and horizontally through the separation of powers, legislative, executive, and judicial. The judicial was supposed to be the weakest branch. It was elected. They were supposed to be unelected and lifetime appointees as to the Supreme Court. They were supposed to interpret laws and not make the laws because they're not elected. They're not reflective of the popular will. And from the very first, in 1803, Marbury versus Madison, Chief Justice Marshall established the doctrine of judicial review, which is the power of the courts to declare acts of the legislature unconstitutional. He arrogated that power to the court when it did not exist. Some people say, well, that was okay. It's only logical that the court would be the proper body to pass on what the constitutionality of laws was. But if it just went there and no farther, it might be okay. But the problem is that the court, in the guise of interpreting the laws and the Constitution and being the final arbiter of the Constitution, has rewritten the Constitution through judicial fiat. And they've done this in case after case in history. They've done it to, for example, emasculate the Establishment Clause, which says, First Amendment Establishment Clause, which is one of the primary guarantors of religious liberty in this country, says Congress shall make no laws establishing, with respect to establishment of religion. Now, that meant that the federal government should not be permitted to establish a national church like the Anglican Church of England. Why? Because if you have a national church, people can't worship as they please. So it was a religious freedom provision, not a provision to separate church and state. In fact, the original government endorsed Christianity in several respects. We don't have time to go into. But through the years, the Supreme Court, on its own decision, on its own fiat, has expanded the Establishment Clause, where it is now being used not as a guarantor of religious liberty, but as a weapon against religious liberty, particularly for Christians. And I could give you examples of that. That's a lot of what my book is about. But in 1947, Everson versus Board of Education, the Supreme Court said that the Establishment Clause henceforth will be applicable to the states through the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, a complete fiction. They did that with some of the other amendments, many of the other amendments. But they also said that separation of church and state is now incorporated in the Constitution. This was some letter from Thomas Jefferson to the Danbury Baptists, separation of church and state. It was not in the Constitution. The framers did not intend for it to be in the Constitution. But that's an example of how the Supreme Court has rewritten the laws to the detriment of liberty because we don't have any accountability. But one of the most egregious examples, though, is the Massachusetts Supreme Court and with the gay marriage situation.
On that issue, and in answer to the question of how do we stop this, then especially with respect to the Supreme Court, it seems either on the state level or on the federal level, the only recourse that the populace has is to amend the Constitution because that's the only authority to which that court answers finally.
To amend the Constitution or to limit the jurisdiction of the federal courts, which is within the Congress's constitutional prerogative, or to impeach judges. Now, those are all very difficult remedies. And that's why some people, like I think Judge Roy Moore, wanted to, in effect, take the law into his own hands and say, these courts are renegade, they're issuing unconstitutional or extra-constitutional decisions, therefore we don't have to honor those decisions. Now, I personally was supportive of Judge Moore's interpretation of the Establishment Clause and of his right to put the monument of the Ten Commandments in the courtroom, but I did not support his decision to defy the federal court order because I subscribe to the view that we have to work within the system unless we're prepared for revolution. And I'm not there yet.
On the issue of gay rights, gay marriage, the news is most lately that the governor of Massachusetts, Mitt Romney, is trying to put some stop to same-sex marriages, which are due to go into effect, as things go in Massachusetts, very early in the month of May.
Yes.
What do you make of this?
I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see how that falls out, but I find it amazing that you could even have a court presuming to assert authority over this issue when everyone knows that the framers of the Massachusetts Constitution could not possibly have intended that marriage mean anything but a union between man and woman. So they were just completely making it up on their own. Imagine the arrogance that would be required to do that. And the problem with the Massachusetts Supreme Court doing it is that other states are arguably bound to honor those decisions through the Full Faith and Credit Clause, and I know there's the counter-argument that the DOMA laws, Defense of Marriage Act, allows states not to, or gives states the right to accept themselves from honoring the Full Faith and Credit in that situation. I'm not sure an act of the Congress will trump the Constitution on Full Faith and Credit. I don't know. But we shouldn't even have to be at that point. It shows the left, the secular left, how they subscribe to this end justifies the means philosophy. That they're anarchy. Look at what they did out in San Francisco. All these municipal judges, without any authority, marrying people of the same sex, defiantly, as if to say, we don't care what your society stands for, you bigots, we're going to do exactly what we want to do. And they're superimposing, in my opinion, by force, by thought tyranny, their value system onto our society. And I'm going to tell you, there is no regime of liberty that has ever been founded on a foundation of irreligion and humanism. It is no accident that the United States is the freest and most prosperous nation in the history of the world. It is precisely because of our Judeo-Christian roots and the framers' belief that man was created in God's image and therefore entitled to dignity and respect. That very belief gave them the idea that man was entitled to dignity and inalienable rights because they were created by a divine, omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent being who made us in his image. And therefore, no government ought to be able to take away those rights. Where else would the idea of inalienable rights come from? These people who say that our framers weren't Christian in orientation. Where would that possibly have come from? If we can, if we were established on the shifting sands of moral relativism, there is no ultimate barrier to keep man from subjugating other man.
Let's talk about another major battleground in the culture war, and that has to do with abortion. Let's go back 30-some-odd years to Roe v. Wade. Is that a good example of judicial activism that we've been living with and people have been dying with, we should point out, for over 30 years?
Probably the best example. You know, these pro-abortionists talk about how if we go back, if Roe versus Wade is repealed, that we'll go back to the situation of back alley abortions, when in fact what would happen is the matter would revert to the states to be decided democratically by their duly elected representatives. It would be a matter of state law, and each state would decide for its own about the legality of abortion. But the federal government issued this edict based on the penumbras and emanations in the Bill of Rights. Of course, those are just fancy words, meaning we're going to use something, we can make something up that sounds authoritative, and outlaw abortion in those certain circumstances where they can do it. But, oh yeah, that's probably the most egregious example. You've got, but I think what, beyond judicial activism, what that case is illustrative of is how our moral fabric is upside down. I find it just utterly amazing that the people who advocate the unbridled murder of the most innocent form of human life, babies in the womb, by the scores of millions each year, not each year, but by scores of millions, are occupying the moral high ground in this country. And the people who oppose them, the people who stand up for innocent life, are treated as moral pariahs. And this is the value system of our popular culture. And if that isn't a statement about where we are culturally, I don't know what is.
You, by the way, folks, you can read the columns that are nationally syndicated, and they also appear on David Limbaugh's website, davidlimbaugh.com, davidlimbaugh.com. David, you have written recently that in the culture war, it's been a little one-sided, and that the people on the right side of this battle have not really taken up arms the way they ought to. Explain what you mean by that.
Yeah, I encountered opposition with my book because a lot of Christians have the idea that Christians should be the salt and light, meaning they should exude Christ-like attitude, and they should not engage in the political arena. This is a spiritual battle. We ought not dirty our hands in the material world. I argue that we were created by God not to be mindless, passive automatons, not to only pray, but to engage the culture. He could have bypassed the material world for us and just zapped us right into heaven, I suppose, but he was put us on earth, and he gave us the Great Commission. He bound us to that, and we are supposed to honor the Great Commission. And I respectfully submit that we will not be able to honor the Great Commission if we don't operate in a climate of political and religious liberty. And you can see that in the Soviet Union, in the communist China. The United States has always prided itself on religious liberty. And by the way, notice I said we were founded by predominantly Judeo-Christian framers, Christian framers, and yet they respect, they preserve the right of all religions in this pluralist society to worship as they please. And somebody has asked me on interviews, well, would you support the right of two Muslims to hold hands in prayer in a kindergarten to pray just like you do Christians? I said, I definitely would, because it is not up to me or any government entity to tell anybody how to worship. It is to preserve their right to worship as they want to. Now, I might try to influence them. I might try to proselytize, not as a teacher, but I mean as a human being. But I am not going to use government power to try to suppress their religious liberties. So it's Christians that preserve religious liberty. We're not theocrats. Another prominent religion, by the way, is. I won't mention any names. Don't want to be controversial. I've been pretty mild in this interview.
David Limbaugh is our guest. We've got about 3 or 4 minutes left with him. In that short amount of time, have we passed the point of no return on abandoning religious liberty in the United States?
Absolutely not. And I am not one of these alarmist, sky is falling type of people. That's why I didn't support Judge Moore in what I thought was an act of civil disobedience, although I respect him and his honorable intentions. I just disagree intellectually with his position. I think we clearly are making inroads in certain levels, in certain pockets. There are some Christian liberty law firms out there that are making remarkable strides. When some of these cases are challenged in court, and I cite those in my book, the Christians are prevailing. Now, the people in our culture, our government officials, are still intimidated, and they have this view that there must be some strict separation between church and state. So even when we win the court cases, you still have you still have public officials honoring this separation of church and state and treating it as pure. But there's so many mixed signals from the judiciary in the various jurisdictions and within the same jurisdiction. I just think we have to keep fighting it. This war for the culture and against Christianity, this effort to scrub away Christianity from the public square and to usher in secular humanism, anti-Christian values into the public square, in our public schools, in the media, and elsewhere in our society, is happening on so many levels that we have to respond on all these different levels. And I think it's going to require a grassroots effort, but at first it's going to require a shaking of Christians out of their complacency and realize, you know, we were all born into a free system. We're spoiled. We didn't have to fight, most of us, for our political liberties and don't realize the sacrifices that are necessary and how exceptional freedom is in the world history. It's not the rule, it's the exception. And we need to understand that it is a precious thing and that we need to fight to preserve it. And we really do need to hang in there and just call attention to Christians and other lovers of liberty, the fact that this war is going on and it's worth fighting, that these people that are opposed to us use all these platitudes like tolerance and open-mindedness, when in fact they show no tolerance toward Christianity and no open-mindedness. I think you just got to be aware there's a war of the word, and truth is the greatest casualty today. Even Christians, I want to close on this. I know we're running out of time.
30 seconds.
I know Pastor Disson will agree with me. Even Christians today refuse to acknowledge the truth. When somebody asks, is Christianity the true religion? Of course it's the true religion. If Christ wasn't God, if he wasn't deity, then he was a liar or a lunatic, as C.S. Lewis said. We don't have any other option available. So we Christians better not offend the finished work of Christ on the cross by saying that there are other ways, because that's a disservice to his finished work and to the Great Commission.
Thank you very much. David Limbaugh. David Limbaugh is attorney here in Cape Girardeau, a syndicated columnist, and marvelous to hear that last comment, just marvelous to hear that last comment. He's author of the book Absolute Power, and his latest book is called Persecution, How Liberals Are Waging War Against Christianity. David, thank you again for being
thank
our guest.
Very much.
You can read his columns on davidlimbaugh.com, davidlimbaugh.com. We hope to have you back sometime. You get another book out there. When we come back from this break, Pastor David Disson will be our guest. He's going to join us here across the table, and we're going to be talking about campus ministry in the golden years of his ministry. How old are you, David?
I'm not going to tell.
Okay.
39.
Older than he wants to say. He has turned his attention toward the youth of the church. We'll be talking about that when we come back and talk about campus ministry with Pastor David Disson. This is Issues Etc. Thank you for listening. We'll be right back live after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.